There's just such a dearth of research out there on wellness in general, and in particular on wellness as it applies to business and the economy and as an industry. I mean, really, the Global Wellness Institute and the research we've been doing was the first to do that.
Welcome to the new podcast series for the Global Wellness Summit, recorded live during our 2019 summit at the Grand Hyatt Singapore. I'm Kim Marshall. Research is a cornerstone of the summit, and the research done each year by the Global Wellness Institute is vital to the entire wellness industry and of growing interest to a wide range of other industries. The research-based trends released by GWI each year are trumpeted by media around the world. So we were lucky to sit down with Ophelia Young and Catherine Johnston, economists who have specialized in tourism, hospitality, and even golf studies at the Stanford Research Institute, and who now spearhead the Global Wellness Institute's annual research studies. Beyond just statistics, you'll hear how Ophelia and Catherine have been surprised by the business community's thirst for this kind of information and delighted by the desire of many business leaders to go beyond just ROI and do something to help create inclusive options for the world's wellness. But before we get to our conversation from these research rock stars, let's take a moment to hear from another dynamic woman who understands the importance of research in the wellness industry, Denise Vitello from Comfort Zone.
We have an amazing team of experts that are always out in the field, and we never believe in too much education. I think one of the best things is in-person education, so we always do a lot of that. And then in addition to that, we also have online education that you can have as a backup.
Later, we'll hear more about the education that spa practitioners receive from Comfort Zone, blending the best of science and customer service in skincare. Welcome back, everybody. Here we are at the Global Wellness Summit 2019 in lovely, amazing, exciting Singapore. And those adjectives could be applied to our two guests today. Can you tell us your names, please, and title?
Hi, Catherine Johnston, Senior Research Fellow at the Global Wellness Institute.
Ophelia Young, Senior Research Fellow at the Global Wellness Institute.
Yes, and I've been to 7 summits and quite a few of the press events in New York that Global Wellness Summit and Global Wellness Institute put on. And you guys are kind of rock stars on the stage there because you have data and research and reports, which is the real thing that all the media and everybody are looking for to quantify what is new and happening. So first, let's start. How did you start working with Susie Ellis and the summit?
Okay, well, this goes back about 11 or 12 years. When the summit was first launched in 2007, mm-hmm. It was originally the Global Spa Summit.
I remember.
And when they had that first summit, they all as a group realized we have no way to talk about our industry because we have no numbers. We know it's growing. We know it's really big. And everybody says, wow, spa, it's this huge industry.
It makes you feel so good.
Yeah. But they had no numbers to verify that. Mm-hmm. And so after that first summit, Susie said, okay, we need to find someone to do numbers for us. And Ophelia and I, at the time, we were economists working at SRI International, or Stanford Research Institute.
That's all just Stanford? Okay, good.
Well, it's not with Stanford. It's a nonprofit.
Oh, okay.
It used to be part of Stanford University, and it split off. But it's one of the oldest think tanks in the world.
Yeah, so we were working on all kinds of industries and projects, but we had been involved in a project to measure the golf industry in the United States and look at what we called the GDP of golf.
Okay.
So what's the economic
impact.
Impact of golf. So Susie just happened to come across that report on the web.
Reading Susie,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, she found us and she said, well, if they can measure golf, I bet they can measure spa. So she came to contacted us and, that's how it all got started. But of course, the spa study is a whole different animal because it was global.
Wow.
You know, the golf work, I mean, we did a lot of global work in our consulting jobs. And so we're used to working in that context.
And Catherine and I, in our business practice, we have been the team that does the most tourism projects. So we have done tourism strategy for Egypt, for Lebanon, for Palm Beach County, for, you know, for Bosnia, for, you know, Czech Republic.
Wow.
We so we're familiar with tourism and hospitality industry.
Which is the core of spas, where this started.
Yeah,
right?
So that, but that's how this project came to us, because like, okay, you two, you're the, you know, the tourism, you know, fluffy stuff, you know, people in at SRI, right?
So let's look about fluffy feeling good wellness, so they thought. So how many years have you been doing research projects then for them, for the Global Wellness Institute?
So that first project was at the summit in 2008. Okay. So we have been doing research for them since that time. In the early years, it was not every year. You know, the recession hit right after that. Mm-hmm. So there, you know, there wasn't a lot of budget for research. Mm-hmm. But starting around 2010, pretty much every year, we came in and did a research project for the summit. And that was around the time that it shifted and became the Wellness Summit. And so then the scope of the research really expanded broadly to then start helping them define, well, what is wellness? If we're going to be a wellness summit and talk about this industry, what is it? How do we measure it? How do we understand what's included?
Well, I happened to be on the at the summit the time that the balls were first introduced, with all the different bubbles of the markets. And there's so many topics we can talk about. When someone Googles Global Wellness Summit or Global Wellness Institute, especially on Google Images, that's one of the first things that comes up. But tell us some of the topics, you know, maybe even beyond that, that you have researched.
So that started when maybe before 2014, right? That's the first time. So Susie said, oh, well, you know, we've done tourism, wellness tourism and spa, but what is the size of the global wellness industry? And what does that even mean, right?
Right.
Global wellness industry. So Catherine and I are economists, and you can't measure anything without seeing what it is. So every time we think about tourism or spa, the first part of the work is actually defining what it is and what we're measuring.
Right.
Because without a boundary, you can't come up with the numbers. Like,
so
whole world is wellness, right?
Yeah.
Oh, everything medical is also wellness, you know, right? So when we started with, you know, what is the size of the global wellness industry? So we really had to think about what industry sector, like, a, you know, then in the traditional sense, might be part of this universe.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually we end up with 10 of them.
10. But you guys will be interested to know that way back when, I guess it was 96 or something, we did media events in New York for the nascent, you know, then burgeoning spa industry. And we tried to have innovative invitations because people didn't know what acupuncture was, Reiki. I mean, nobody wore yoga pants to work in those early years. So we'd do what's hot, what's not, what's in, what's out. But one year it was a crossword puzzle. And the media had to fill it in to find out the location of the luncheon. And we put the word spa and then what intersected that word. And it was so many of the bubbles that you guys study. But let's get specific and talk about what some of those topics have been that you've researched in wellness.
Sure. So one of the first sectors that we did a deep dive into was wellness tourism, which was back around 2012. And that's because here at the summit, you know, there are a lot of people at the summit who are involved in hospitality very broadly, and spa and hotels, resorts, and so on. And so there was a lot of talk about wellness tourism, and people had a sense, this is happening, this is popular, this is a trend, but nobody really knows what it is.
Right.
You know, Susie was also concerned that the term was being used very generically. You know, is this medical? Is this not medical? What's medical tourism? Is it different?
Mm-hmm.
And so we did a study to really clarify that and define what is wellness tourism. It's not the same as medical. Measure it. And so that was one of the first sectors we really took a deep dive and looked into in a big way. From there, then what we started doing is each year, every other year, we try to take a deep dive into one of those other bubbles in that wellness economy chart. So we did a study on wellness in the workplace. And then one of our next and our favorite studies, I think, is looking at wellness communities and wellness real estate.
I remember you talked about your house and where you lived and if you drove or what the access to park space and things were.
Yeah, I remember that. And then the latest study then was the deep dive into what started as fitness and mind-body, but it became much bigger. We redefined that sector as physical activity.
And let me tell you something. I was so surprised to see this because, you know, the Institute, the Global Wellness Institute, has been, to me, quite intellectual. And, you know, lots of times people in general could think that fitness is just, you know, like protein shakes and big muscles and whatever. But instead, you folks realize that this is you know, a human need. It's the difference between health and sickness. And it's also, what did you find? An $828.2 billion global business, right? Mm-hmm. And you spent a year studying this topic. Let's give the formal topic. The report, research report for 2019, Move to Be Well, The Global Economy of Physical Activity. So how big was that study? How many pages?
Maybe 180 pages with appendices. So it's not the number of pages and the words in there. It's a long study, but it's the data. We actually created six streams of data within this for every country in the world. And then we wrote about every region in the world and had examples on what's happening. So it's not the length of it. And often the business community, they're excited about the number because they, you know, for fundraising or for publicity and for different reasons. But a big part of our work is contextualize it. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do with this number? What does that mean? And for us personally, if the number only means, more investors coming in because there is like a profit margin,
to be
personally,
heard.
We're not that motivated. So we always wanted to look at sort of like a bigger picture. What is really happening and what does that mean for people in the world if this sector grows?
Yeah, and also we've really felt the last several years that it's very important to broaden people's thinking about what wellness and the wellness industry is and kind of shift the conversation. Because there is a lot of misconception that, and you know, even this research started in spa, and spa traditionally has been something that is a little bit elitist.
A lot of it elitist.
It's only accessible to certain part of the population.
Unless you go to a public hot spring, right? Yeah. It's hard to access.
And so we really like to put the emphasis on saying that wellness is not that, and that it is something that is critical for everyone. And then we really need to think inclusively and expand access because prevention and all of these things are essential given the problems that we have in the world.
It's so true. You know, we keep talking about our podcast production crew and I were all born in Ohio. They still live there. And there's a lot of sitting going on in my upbringing. And when I started to work for Deborah Zakei, who is, we call the godmother of the spa industry, right? And I realized what they were saying. It really boiled down to drink water and walk. Just move. And I love this about your research that you say it doesn't have to be gyms, yoga, fit tech. No, it can even just be playing catch with your kids, dancing, biking to work. What was surprising to you about finding out the potential for that sort of?
I would say it's not just the research, is every time, like for example, people at the summit, they're mostly from business. So, you know, they might be related to the fitness industry or maybe they run a big hospitality company with some fitness component. And you would think that what they really want is, oh, how big is it? How can we invest? Where do we invest? Make more money, get more customers. And whenever we broaden this and say, you know, it's not about your gym that you build. It's really, you know, are more people moving more so that more people are healthy, especially people who don't have access to these things. What surprised me is every time that message resonates with the business community, which is what gives me hope. Because often we have the business community and the public sector, and then it's like the public sector people, you know, philanthropy or, you know, pay for poor people, whatever.
Right.
Business people make their money. But when you have business people that, you know, that have this kind of message resonate, it's very powerful to then work with the public sector. So it's just very motivating for us.
And also when I find here, we've talked a lot of business leaders on the podcast these few days, and many of them have had their own health epiphany. Like, if I want to keep running the show, I better keep my body working. And it's a pretty simple equation, right? The fitness element, adding it to your life. What surprised you about 150 countries were included in this study?
Is that close to 200.
Oh my goodness. And what surprised you on a global scale with this topic?
I think once we broaden the topic from fitness to physical activity and all the different iterations that you see in there, so all the sports and outdoor recreation and all those different activities people can do to move, it was really interesting to then dig more deeply into different regions around the world and see the different kinds of activities that people do. I mean, it's very culturally rooted mm-hmm. and, you know, different places have different things that are happening that people in the United States or, in, you know, in certain places don't even know about. And so, you know, you see, for example, in Latin America, how much public sector attention and investment has been put into providing free fitness classes in all these cities all over Latin America. And it's really interesting to read about that and think, you know, how is this a model
wow.
that could be used in other places? And then, you know, jump over to China and the plaza dancing phenomenon, which we're going to talk about in our session this afternoon at
plaza
the summit,
dancing?
Is so fascinating.
Is
and
it
so
Tai
cool.
Chi or what is it?
No. It's they like call them the dancing grannies.
it's really, I think it's based more on the square dancing steps.
Cool.
And then it started with mainly women, and then they bring a boombox and, you know, maybe it could be Tiananmen Square or whatever, you know,
yeah.
their square, and they blast the music and then do their square dance routines, and it became like group dancing routines.
Oh my
and then
God.
And then it could be like hundreds of grannies doing it, women and men, and then there are competitions, and then
they use costumes and props.
Yes, and now the Guinness Book of World Records, they have the largest plaza dancing, like 15,000 people doing plaza dance, and there are people at all ages, a lot of grannies.
But this is physical activity.
Yes,
it doesn't
of course.
Cost them anything to do it. You don't need special facilities.
Right.
I mean, there are just so many ways people can do this.
And Americans don't know about this, right? Yeah. And then when we saw the videos, and we're going to show some later today, it just makes you smile.
Well, listen, I'm married to a Cuban. He was born in Havana, but raised in America. And I will tell you, every time we come with a group of Latin friends and relatives, somehow dancing is involved. And you know, it doesn't matter. You can dance. I could dance with you and I could dance with somebody's uncle. Dancing is joy. Dancing is life. And one of the most fun things of any gathering is when someone like my husband, who has trophies in salsa, is to grab a grandma and start dancing with them, an abuela. And I know that's not just the Latin culture, right?
Oh, yeah, it's all around the world. I mean, we think dancing is, I mean, it's so under-recognized as a sort of a wellness trend and a physical activity, you know, thing that people can do. Actually, another thing that surprised us is, you know, when people say fitness, you think, you know, the typical gym and, you know, we know what fitness is, right?
Right, what it looks like.
But, you know, one of the things that we were not aware of is how many free outdoor gyms there are all around the world. And again, this is mostly outside of the United States. It's in Latin America and Southeast Asia and China, India.
How did you come across that? Just
we research
digging
everything.
Around. Okay.
So we counted, over 21,000 of them. And that's definitely a low number. I'm sure there are more. But, you know, there are companies specialized in creating this outdoor, you know, workout equipment that mimics things that are in gyms, but it's very low tech. It's outside. Wow. It's in a park. It's free and everyone can go use it. And they're really popular.
It's not just pull up bars. There are things that are like treadmills and
or like step machines.
Step machines. And they're outdoor. They're, you know, not mechanized.
It's crazy.
They're like all weather.
Move to Be Well and plaza dancing? Did you ever think there could be such joy found in research? But before we hear more about the trends that will be impacting us in the months ahead, let's hear a bit more from Denise at Comfort Zone. I don't think listeners around the world realize how hard skincare brands work to train their spas. So how often are you sending trainers in the field? Who wants to answer that?
I think it's an ongoing, continual effort. There is no right and wrong answer on that. I think that we have an amazing team of experts that are always out in the field, and we never believe in too much education. I think one of the best things is in-person education, so we always do a lot of that. And then in addition to that, we also have online education that you can have,
which helps to, you know, it's key to actually meet the trainer, the teacher in person, but I think it's also important to be able to get back, because sometimes you know, you need to refresh what you've learned, or you need to get it deeper. So that's very good, because people can go online and get deeper in what they've listened to, and they have videos, so it helps them. I think, you know, the two parts have to be together.
You can learn more about Comfort Zone and their partnership with the Carillon Miami Wellness Resort by visiting carillonhotel.com. That's C-A-R-I-L-L-O-N hotel.com. Now let's get back to our conversation with Ophelia Young and Katherine Johnston. Well, one thing that personally I've noticed is, I mentioned yoga pants before. There's two people from Lululemon here at the summit. And of course, to people who dress like that, which is a whole lot of us, I live in LA and it's more the norm than not. Lululemon also represents community and a gathering point because you trust it. If I go in there, my pants aren't going to rip, and also the class is going to be good, and maybe it's going to be outside in the park. But the other phenomenon is this Peloton meet your group on the screen of your bike. What did you find about that? Anything? Did that come up? The virtual group classes?
It's very interesting. The first time I heard about Peloton is actually from my Chinese friends in Hong Kong.
Oh.
These are not Tai Tai. I mean, they're professional women. They're very busy. So, there are very high quality spin classes in Hong Kong, but some of my friends are very busy. So they would order the Peloton together so they can get like group shipping rates. And so, you know, people in Hong Kong can ride live with people in United States.
Or Dubai or whatever.
Or Dubai, yes. But then you have to recognize the bike that is $2,000 and you buy all the cleats and all the mats,
right.
And then you get the, the subscription.
Yeah.
It is for, and then for Hong Kong people to even have that kind of room for a bike.
Space in their
place.
I
mean, we're talking that real estate probably costs more than a lot of people's houses in other countries. So it's a slice of population. So we don't want to, when we did mention Peloton in the report.
Yes.
But that's
it's not the only option out there, right?
Isn't
so
that great?
Actually, here's another cool surprise that came in when we started looking at the fitness tech, which Peloton is part of that, you know, growing segment of, you know, we can use technology in all kinds of ways, you know, from the equipment to the apps, the streaming to give people different options. But one thing we realized late in the game is the fitness gaming. And call it extra gaming. And that's been
it's
around
crazy.
A long time. Not, a lot much longer than Peloton. I mean, that goes back a couple decades.
WeFit.
Yeah,
right?
Like WeFit and Dance Dance Revolution.
Right.
Which came out in the 90s, was the first big sort of tech-based fitness game that you can do in your home. And it's really cheap.
My son and his friend did it all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's actually, we count that as part of the fitness industry because it is. And it's so accessible
Pokemon Go.
And fun. And
it
is. Pokemon
it gets you up and moving.
Yes. So people like to talk about Peloton, but all these other things are part of it too.
Yeah.
So I suppose researchers aren't supposed to give advice, but you guys have been exposed to so much. Tell me what three hopeful things from this study have been to you, that you found, three hopeful things.
You're going to make us think.
I know.
There are a lot of models in the world. If one place can learn from another place, there are actually a lot of solutions. Like, for example, yoga, we think of still, you know, in the United States, that's a pretty, you know, it's like, oh, you're, you know, ladies wearing a Lululemon and you're sort of downscale, then you practice at the YMCA, right? It's a module for community healing in Africa. We're talking people who are child soldiers who are now recruited as yoga teachers, and so they could give yoga classes. And so it's an employment opportunity and also for spiritual and sort of healing.
Isn't that wonderful? We don't
really hear about it as much in the United States. I know there is some prison yoga program, but have we done more in our inner cities? Or, you know, it's interesting to see what you can learn from different places, that there are things we can do in different countries.
And that's
by
really,
learning.
That's really the point of the word global.
Yeah, I would say another really important thing is, you know, going back to talking about whether wellness is elitist, and, you know, we like to talk about democratizing it and being more inclusive. This sector, the physical activity, already is so accessible to people because there are so many options out there, as we've just talked about, that are free and easy for people to do. It's just, this is a place that can be so effective in addressing the issues that we have with chronic disease and, you know, trying to do more preventive approaches. I mean, the opportunities here are huge to reach a lot of people in very simple ways and very low-cost ways. And so that gives me a lot of hope just to see, you know, again, how many things are happening out there in the world that are really cool models that we could all learn from and apply
and maybe
in our regions.
From, right? One of them that I always hear at this summit is about mental wellness and depression and whatever. And also people trying to stay married or stay in a relationship. And I personally believe there's nothing better than a walk together with your mate to talk about the day, to reconnect, to be healthy, take the dogs, get your endorphins going. So that's real hope. Now let me ask the two of you a final question. After all this research and this, to me, really hopeful topic of wellness, you know, what has been really surprising to you about the reaction through these years to your findings?
I would say how much hunger there is for this information.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just such a dearth of research out there on wellness in general, and particularly on wellness as it applies to business and the economy and as an industry. I mean, really, the Global Wellness Institute and the research we've been doing was the first to do that.
Yeah, groundbreaking.
Yeah, it's actually really exciting for us to do this work because it's so gratifying mm-hmm. and just exciting to see that we're putting this out into the world and that businesses need this and they use it. And people come and say, oh my gosh, your numbers were so helpful. I did X, Y, and Z. Oh. I launched a business.
Yeah. And
so it's exciting to be able to put all of this stuff on paper and see that it's having an impact.
Yeah, I swear. We talked about Susie Ellis, the co-founder of the Global Wellness Summit, blah, 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 and the Institute. Started out in fitness, right? And mm-hmm. for me to see that all these things you're doing to be, you know, quoted all the time in the Wall Street Journal, in Time, whatever, I'm like, I think I've heard of that before. But how about you, Ophelia? What surprised you?
I think there is such a hunger for a more systematic look at the wellness industry. So every time we do a new sector, we're trying to go beyond the numbers first, just not you go beyond just how big it is, but what is its connection to other aspects of wellness and what it really means for the world. Mm-hmm. And it's always very encouraging that the reaction from the business community is that they're so hungry. They are actually, most people are, they are a little bit above just making money. I think that's at least in their hearts. Mm-hmm. There is a desire to think a little more than just my margin and ROI and
yeah.
all that.
Yeah.
And every time the reaction to our research when we try to push the envelope a little and not just, oh yeah, you build this, you're gonna like, you know, have a
really
little bit of
money.
Competitive edge. And people are actually, I mean, we're not expert in that. You don't look to me for that. So if we try to just push out the message and the thinking, and people just seem to be so hungry. So it's exciting for us that if we do this and then we kind of help people think. And then there are these other, so we're just more like think tank, right?
Yeah.
So then the rest of them are the doers.
Aww.
So if we can in any way enable them, just push it because they don't have the time and the luxury that we have to think about it, which is to us really, we recognize it as a privilege. That
Aww.
We get, you know, we get the time to think. And
well, let me tell you, from observing you, lovely ladies, for the past number of years, you seem quite joyful in your approach, even though it's scientific and it's research. And I'll just tell the listeners, Google the names of these lovely ladies because they're research rock stars in the wellness space. And thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to this first series of podcasts from the Global Wellness Summit. Please head to globalwellnesssummit.com to learn more and click on the Global Wellness Trends tab to see complete trend reports from the past few years. I'm Kim Marshall from Swell Public Relations, and thanks for listening.